Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Now, before we get to our first guests for this hour, I want to alert you that right now on our politics website, itsafreecountry.org, we have a brand new expose of design problems with the New York State election ballots. You just heard it referred to on the news. This just came to our attention via the Brennan Center late yesterday, and so we've worked up an annotated ballot to show you how to avoid voting for the wrong person on November 2nd. For example, if you want to vote for Carl Paladino on the taxpayer party line, and we know how many of you do, it looks to us like it'll be all too easy to accidentally vote for Howie Hawkins, the Green Party candidate. So you can see the whole story of the election ballot design problems, including visually the actual ballot, the annotated ballot, pointing out the problems at our politics website, itsafreecountry.org. Also on the site, by the way, we have a new blog post from Feed Into Worlds reporter Annie Coryell about Kirsten Gillibrand trying to make peace with the immigrant community. It's all at itsafreecountry.org. Well, three of our favorite political reporters have just completed road trips to see up close what's happening around the country in this election season. Sometimes they found the same things. Sometimes they saw things differently. WNYC's Andrea Bernstein is just back from Michigan and Ohio reporting for our Transportation Nation project. Public Radio's Farai Shadeya is just back from Florida and Arizona. She will have a special about her Florida trip airing on WNYC tonight at 8. It's called Poppin' Politics. And Joe Klein from Time Magazine, just back from a 6,000-mile road trip across the country and back, the basis for his cover story in this week's issue. Welcome to all of you.
Good to be here.
Good morning.
And let's talk about emotion first. Farai, you saw a lot of anger in Florida. Joe, you write about less anger than anxiety. Joe, do you think the anger of the Tea Party has been overreported and something else missed?
Yeah, I think the Tea Party represents about a third of the country. And, you know, there's a lot of frustrated anger. I mean, if the first 5 minutes, people vent. But when you get past the first 5 minutes, they start to express some real concerns and anxieties that are very reasonable and very logical. You know, the biggest concern is that they don't think that their kids are going to live as well as they have, that the country is sliding backward. And they don't see, you know, a major recovery or where the next generation of new jobs is going to come from.
Farai, is that what you saw in Florida and Arizona?
I saw a lot of anger, and but it doesn't contradict what Joe's saying. I mean, the anxiety is the bed of the anger. And, for example, we spoke with William Julius Wilson, the Harvard sociologist, who basically says that in tough times, racial anxiety, xenophobia, all of those things bubble up. So it's not one or the other. And so, for example, when we went to Gainesville right before the planned Quran burning that never happened and spoke with Muslim Americans, Christians, all sorts of folks. And
because it was going to be in that area.
It was going to be right there in Gainesville. And one of the things that happened was that I was on the road with three producers, all of whom are white. Two of the white producers went out and they talked to these guys and they said things that I don't think they would have said to me. You know, they talked about the retarded voters in Harlem who voted in Obama and made a lot of racial comments. I think it depends on what skin you're in, what people will say to you.
And Andrea, what about in Jackson, Michigan and Canton, Ohio, where you just were?
You know, it's hard to sort of untangle all the threads. I mean, I do think Joe is right that the Tea Party has become sort of overblown as a kind of movement in the general election. But that doesn't mean that the Tea Party isn't expressing a sort of undercurrent of emotion in voters. And, you know, these places, Michigan, Ohio, I mean, these are depressed areas of the country that, you know, have not had a sort of good economic end of the stick for a long time. And, you know, one of the things that I sort of think is sort of contributing to this emotional crash is, you know, voters allowed themselves in 2008 to be caught up in this sort of yes, we can moment. And it hasn't gotten better. It's gotten worse in many cases. Unemployment has gone up in these areas. And there were, you know, there's voter after voter who said to me, where's the change? And this, I think, is, you know, part of the problem. I mean, there's a whole lot of things mixed in. There are state government cuts that are making people angry, service cuts. There are, a raise in fees. It's astounding to what extent. I mean, in Michigan, I was talking to people about the GM bailout, where you would think that would be just a huge home run. But no, people were sort of, you know, why did the big company get something and I got nothing?
Explain that. Why would that be seen? And that, to me, was one of the most interesting things in your report from carmaker country in Michigan, that the auto bailout, while seen as a success by most economists and largely for preserving jobs, is not making him a hero in and around that area.
Because it's a sort of a mixed emotion. I mean, you sort of think about, you know, who does a large bailout appeal to? Well, almost nobody. Almost nobody. I mean, people are sort of ambivalent about the result. They're like, yeah, I guess it saved the job, but I wish it didn't have to happen that way. And by the way, where's my new car? I mean, I saw the most rusted out cars in the parking lot of Jackson, Michigan's Walmart than I've seen almost anywhere in the country. And this is in the place where we're in the state where cars are made.
Now, and
yeah, Brian, you know, the when I was in Michigan, the common, you know, what you'd hear would be, we're all buying Fords because they didn't go for the bailout. But at the same time, a lot of the people who I was talking to are able to, to stay in the jobs that they have, because not only the automakers are still in business, but all of their suppliers are still in business. It's really had an impact. And when you go to a place like Lordstown, Ohio, where Chevy has opened a new product line, creating, you know, over 1,000 new jobs, it is a home run.
You know, one of the things that really strikes me about this is that people have a hard time applying their political philosophy to the actual situation in their life. So in Yuma, Arizona, I went to a Tea Party event, and there's this big push for smaller government, and we talked to a couple. And I started, you know, Yuma has a 23% unemployment rate, one of the highest in the country. It's out in the desert. They irrigate, grow lettuce. They have a ton of border patrol and military. That's it. Everybody else pretty much is unemployed. So you go there and I'm like, well, you want a smaller government. What about border patrol cuts? No. Military cuts? No. Agricultural subsidy cuts? No. Social Security cuts? You got a lot of retirees? No. Nobody wants to give up anything. And yet, you know, anyway.
Balance the state budget. Don't cut my schools. We'll have side-by-side protests for those two things. Andrea and Joe, you both wrote about, and if you're just joining us, my guests are Andrea Bernstein, Joe Klein, and Farai Shadea, all three just back from political reporting road trips. You both wrote about China being on people's lips a lot right now. Joe, you said for every one time a voter mentioned the war in Afghanistan during your trip, 25 people mentioned China. What are they saying about China?
Well, they believe that China is on its way to being number one. They are infuriated by the outsourcing of jobs to China, and they're hearing now that China's moving ahead of us in some high tech areas like green technology. But it's part of a larger narrative. They're beginning to look at Wall Street in a certain way. It's not just big government they can't stand. It's big Wall Street that they can't stand. They see these investment bankers as the people who bought up their local factories, merged them into conglomerates in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, stripped the research and development functions out of those companies because they weren't producing short-term profits, and then shipped the jobs out to China. And when they were finished doing that, they turned their attention to the housing market and created these subprime mortgages, which, you know, gave loans to people who should never, ever have gotten them. And then they created these, you know, financial derivative casino gaming products so that they could bet on those mortgages. So they see a trend over 40 years of completely irresponsible behavior by the financial community. They don't see the government responding to that. They don't see the president. They don't know what the president thinks about China. He hasn't said anything about it. And so they're very upset about that.
Andrea, where did you hear about China?
Well, it's definitely a storyline that is being stoked by Democrats in a lot of these swing districts who, you know, in many cases were really caught off guard and slipped a lot farther, a lot faster than they thought. I mean, I don't want to suggest that, you know, Democrats are the source of negative advertisements because they're flooding the airwaves in ways I have never seen in, you know, a couple of decades of political reporting. I mean, from Chamber of Commerce, from the NRA. But one of the narrative lines being stoked by Democrats, and it's sort of potent against a lot of these sort of Tea Party and Republican candidates because they're running as business people. They're saying, you know, I'm somebody who's actually created jobs. So the Democrats are coming back with a storyline that says, yeah, and you sent a bunch of, you know, you bought a bunch of stuff from the Chinese. So it's something that is being, you know, stoked, but especially in areas Rust Belt areas where jobs just, you know, are going away. When I was in Canton, Ohio, one woman ticked off the names of the companies that had left and, you know, the last decade, and it's just enormous, all the companies that have left. And you know, it's a real anxiety.
Farai, did you hear about...
I'm hearing it from Republicans as well. You know, even Republicans are now saying, did we really do this to our middle class? And, you know, when the middle class looks at us and looks at free trade, why would they ever vote for us?
But they come up with different solutions to it, the Democrats and Republicans, Joe?
Well, I don't think anybody has solutions. It's really a very, very difficult problem because, you know, you're not going to bring those jobs back. And the question is, what are you going to be able to preserve that's here now, and what are you going to be able to create that's different? And do we actually need to do things like slapping tariffs on the Chinese because of their currency manipulation, which, you know, lowers their prices by about 20%?
Farai, you hear people talking about China in Florida and Arizona, or not so much?
No, because, you know, both of these states have large immigrant populations, and I think that the question there that came up more on my road trips was, do you let more people into this country who you see as economic engines, or do you bar people because they're economic, dead weight?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a fundamental difference. We talked to this one guy from Condo Vultures in Miami who said, open the border. Let people from other countries buy all of this property that's sitting here rotting because Americans can't afford it. And that's completely different, needless to say, than a lot of other folks.
But if China is the source of, perception of otherness in Andrea and Joe, some of your reporting, Farai, your Poppin' Politics Florida special airing tonight does delve into different notions of otherness, and I think you were starting to get at some of this before. It's almost as if white voters feel they can't talk about President Obama being black, so it's leaking out in other ways?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, this teenage college student who helps run a Muslim students group at the university in Gainesville said, basically, it's our turn. Those were literally her words. And what she meant by that was, you know, black people, you know, got slammed at a certain point. Latinos get slammed. It's our turn as Muslims to basically take the weight of America's xenophobia. So we saw a sort of displacement of some of that anxiety, the black/Muslim, as one person put it, president. Of course, that's inaccurate, but, you know, facts never got in the way of opinions.
And the three-way U.S. Senate race in Florida is ethnically interesting, with a Cuban Tea Party candidate, Marco Rubio, a white Greek-American centrist, Charlie Crist, at least he's running as a centrist, and a black liberal Democrat, Kendrick Meek. So does race come explicitly into it?
You know, what's funny is that it doesn't. It does that Senate race, basically race is the last thing. You know, you have Crist having left the Republican Party. You have this question about, you know, what's the two-party system? And, you know, you have all these other questions about teachers' unions, which Crist favored, and Marco Rubio, who I wouldn't call a Tea Party candidate, but who is favored by Tea Party voters. But race actually is sort of out of the race.
So it's jobs, 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 and the sense that America may be starting a long-term decline.
But it also is race, but in a different way. It isn't so much racism as, especially in these Tea Party places, which, you know, have been all white until recently. It's the fact that the face of the nation is changing. You know, The South Asians have come in and they're running the mini marts. By the way, that is a cliche that is so true. It wasn't until I got to Kansas where I found a gas station owner who didn't come from Gujarat. But there's that. There's the tide of Latino immigrants. And on top of that, for these older folks, they see their grandchildren coming out as gay or dating interracially. And then you have a president of the United States who doesn't have the good sense to be either black or white. He's somewhere in the middle with a Muslim middle name. It's a fear that the country that they knew is slipping away.
So,
of course, that is the part of the country, you know, that is an aspect of America that I, as a New Yorker, love the best. I mean, it's what gives us our strength is this diversity.
Except that, I mean, one of the interesting things is about race, and I was in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, which is in northeastern Pennsylvania, Luzerne County, the kind of place that, you know, voted for Hillary Clinton in the primary against Obama by 80%. And this was the sort of, you know, the sort of Clinton infamously named white Americans that were never going to vote for Obama. Interestingly, they did. That county elected Obama over John McCain. So there's a sense of grievance from the sort of maybe 30% of the country that, you know, said to me, I'm not voting for the black Muslim who's Christian pastor, I don't believe. And those people have really nursed it. But there is a sort of swing vote for whom that has become, you know, sort of less of an issue in these white, poor counties and, you know, a lot of these swing areas in the country.
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, there is a third of the public who hates the president and thinks he's a secret Muslim. The rest of the public, even the independents, even the people who are going to vote Republican this year because they're angry about what's happening or not happening in Washington, have a certain amount of respect for the president. They say, well, he's a smart guy, he's an honorable guy, he's just wrong, or why isn't he trying harder, or why isn't he doing this or that? There's still a reservoir of respect for the man, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in general, what we saw was a question of, do you blame the president for the mess we're in now, or do you think that he inherited the problems? That's one thing that divides voters, and not just along racial lines, although majority of black voters by far think that he just inherited the problems.
20 seconds each. Did you find in general that people are as polarized about what to do, and you laughed at the idea of solutions before, but as polarized about what to actually do as watching Fox News and MSNBC would suggest? Or not so much as we may think, Fry?
I think a lot of people are deadened. They are deadened to the possibility of a solution.
Somebody said to me in Ohio last week something that I never could have heard in 2008. He said, the best thing would be for nothing to happen, because whatever they do, they could only make it worse.
Joe?
Well, I, to answer your question, I don't think that they're as polarized as they see on Fox News or MSNBC. And in fact, they are wildly ticked off at us, at the media. They, you know, they say, why is all this screaming going on all the time? One guy said to me, why is it when I turn on CNN and they have news from Afghanistan, I'm watching Bill Bennett and Donna Brazile talk about it? Why aren't you guys doing a better job? So I think that, you know, there's more unanimity out there than we like to portray, because contentiousness, you know, we believe gets an audience, but the audience is really getting a little bit tired of the contentiousness.
WNYC's Andrea Bernstein is just back from Michigan and Ohio. You can see her writings at transportationnation.org. Public Radio's Farai Shadeya is just back from Florida and Arizona. She'll have a special about her Florida trip airing on WNYC tonight at 8 called Pop and Politics. And Joe Klein from Time Magazine, just back from a 6,000-mile road trip across the country and back, the basis for his cover story in this week's issue. Thank you all very much for sharing your travels with us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer.
My pleasure.
On WNYC.